Welcome back again to Red Star Radio. It's another daily bulletin covering the war in Ukraine and the political and economic fallout from the war. Now, today I wanted to go into a little bit of detail about how the propaganda campaigns around this war have worked. And these are propaganda campaigns with the roots that stretch back quite a long way into the last decade. And the roots need to be explained in order that we can actually understand why this propaganda is taking root and why it's so easy for journalists, and I'm using that term in heavy inverted commas, to invent some of the stories that they have done. And so I'll start off, though, by talking a little bit about the various front lines that are in existence and where there are developments at the moment, and then I'll move into the discussion of the propaganda later on in the program. First, we look at the situation around Kherson, which has been all over the headlines in recent days and indeed weeks, with the much expected Ukrainian counteroffensive so far hasn't really emerged. There have been several Ukrainian attacks which have been repulsed, reportedly with heavy casualties and loss of armored vehicles and other military equipment. The Russian sources that are most usually correct on these things are saying that the Ukrainians are going to make a major attempt to push through to Kherson City in the next few days, so this week coming up. Bearing in mind that there are credible reports, as I've mentioned before, that the timetable for this is being set in the United States and it is being set by a political agenda of the Democratic Party, which wishes to flaunt a big victory before the midterms. And I think, as I've said before, that that is a huge miscalculation. I think most Americans aren't going to give a fuck what the hell happens in Kherson and whether the Ukrainians take a city there. They are far more concerned about the price they're paying for petrol and the escalating cost of living crisis. And if you believe that inflation is only running around about 10%, then, well, you clearly haven't been paying attention either in Britain or the United States, because the inflation crisis is bumping up prices even more than the official rate of inflation. And we all know the statistics are duped on that anyway. My point is that it's a flawed assumption at the very best by the Democrats if they think it's going to lead to a victory. The other side of it is, of course, that if Ukraine gets another big victory that they can flaunt about, they can use it to beat the potentially unwilling European nations over the head with and say, just a few more tanks, just a few more air defense systems, just a bit more aid, keep the money switch on. And of course, Ursula von der Leyen, the corrupt maniac that runs the European Union, or the president of the European Commission, I should say, was more than willing to commit the European Union to more and more funding for Ukraine. Just as the Democrats, in advance of a likely loss in November, are looking to shove through a $50 billion funding package before they have to give up control of Congress. Whether they'll get that through or not, of course, is another issue. But the main offensive, everybody expects the Ukrainian armed forces to make it in the next few days. So that's a thing to keep an eye on, as is, of course, the Russian and allied forces offensive up near Bakhmut and around Bakhmut, which continues apace. And so far, no clear conclusion there, but the advances seem to be being made by both the Russian army and the Wagner group as they painstakingly go through stronghold by stronghold of the Ukrainian armed forces and slowly evict them from the outskirts of the city. They have largely cleared out the industrial zone, and now they're moving through public buildings such as schools and evicting the Ukrainian defenders bit by bit. It seems to be a long, slow process, but that is the way the Russians are choosing to fight, and it seems to be working for them thus far. There are other things that are coming out, of course, from the further north, from Bakhmut up near the Kharkov area, where, again, it seems that the Russian forces are on the offensive again and going even back towards Krasny Liman, which they notoriously lost just before the mobilization was announced. In other news around military developments, there appears to be something very serious in terms of Russian buildup going on inside Belarus. Thanks to Niall, one of our subscribers, who posted in the Telegram chat recently some information that was quite interesting about the traffic cameras being turned off in certain regions of Belarus, which was mirroring what happened in January of this year when the Russians were moving significant forces through the country. Which leads us up to the question of what the hell are they going to do in terms of a move through Belarus. Just before I get to that, though, it's worth pausing because the Ukrainians accused the Russians of militarily occupying Belarus this week, which is a charge which is being made to basically justify the Ukrainians' attempts at some kind of terrorism or insurgency campaign that they're collaborating with the Belarusian opposition on, which is the claim of the Lukashenko-led government there. But it's worth just saying that if you look into the legalities of the Russia-Belarus constitutional arrangement, which dates all the way back to the declaration of the what's known as the Union State back in 1997 in a treaty that was signed by Lukashenko, who has been around a long time now, and Boris Yeltsin, if you remember him. Everybody's trying to forget, I would imagine. But the treaty set up a kind of reimposition of certain aspects of the old way in which the Soviet Union was run, which was nominally a union of states. And this was a union arrangement between Russia and Belarus. It's has a president of the union state, which is Lukashenko. And Lukashenko apparently wanted to leverage this to try and make himself into president of all of the, including covering Russia when Yeltsin was disposed of. But Putin's coming into office seems to have nixed that. But originally, this was something that was meant to be have an elected parliament attached to it, a court system attached to it, and neither of which have really gotten going. But in terms of the Russian military presence in Belarus, that is completely legal under the terms of the Union State and under the military arrangements with which the two conduct themselves. So it's the military doctrine of the Russian Federation and Belarus makes it clear that an attack on one of the members of the Union State will be treated as if it was an attack on, well, all of them. So if there is, for instance, and this is relevant directly to the maneuvering done by the Poles and the Lithuanians near the Belarusian border recently, if the Poles or the Lithuanians, in reality, Lithuania doesn't have much of an army, but if the Poles were, for instance, to attack Belarus, it would be an attack on Russia, as if they were attacking Russia proper. And that is the reason why, of course, the Poles will not do it, unless, of course, they are firmly backed up by the United States, and the US won't do that because then that's nuclear conflict. And that is something that even the nut jobs that run around the State Department and the incompetent buffoons in the Pentagon know enough to avoid. And no matter what the mad dogs of Warsaw or the mad dogs of Riga and Vilnius and Tallinn think, the United States is not going to sacrifice its own interests to placate the lunatics in Warsaw. And the lunatics in Warsaw might find that out sooner rather than later. But it's worth just emphasizing that the presence of Russian forces in Belarus is legal according to the Union State arrangements and the legal process that governs the usage of military forces within the two countries. It's all done according to that. And Ukraine is just bullshitting when they're saying Belarus is occupied. They're just getting rather worried about what the intentions are, which leads me to look at what the intentions could be. Now, back in late February, early March of this year, when the Russian special military operation started, which I'm surprised that they're still sticking with that term, but there you go, it's their preferred terminology. When this began, they moved rapidly towards Kiev. Of course, they landed in an airborne landing of troops at Gostomel Air Base near Kiev. This time, there's various different theories floating around out there and amongst Russian military observers, particularly those on Telegram. And the theory seems to be that this time, and again, these are theoretical discussions at the moment. None of us are on Surovikin's mailing list. The theory seems to be that the Russian forces this time might go west from the entry into Ukraine in order to seal off the rest of the country. In other words, make a dash for the border area near Poland in order that they can, as far as they can and as quickly as they can, cut off land routes into Ukraine that are supplying weapons via the NATO countries. Knowing full well that, of course, that the Americans won't risk an out-and-out confrontation, And without the Americans, the Poles aren't going to risk it either, no matter how much the mad dogs of Warsaw foam at the mouth. So that is one possible plan for this, that they aim to bypass Kiev, go maybe surround it and go around it and make a run further west of the country, cutting it off from land routes into the rest of Europe. And if that were to happen, that would be a huge blow to the Kiev regime. It would be a potentially fatal one without those land routes in and out of the country being accessible, because that wouldn't leave the NATO forces with an awful lot of choice but to try and either get in by air or the more difficult route down near the mountains near the border with Romania. So that's one potential plan. And this potential plan and the moving towards what could be, if not the end of this war, then the end of the beginning, to paraphrase old Churchill himself, is causing a lot of speculation to fly around the American side of things, including an article that was run by CBS recently, which several people sent to me both on Twitter and on Telegram, and citing an interview with the officers of the 101st Airborne Division, which is one of the more elite paratrooper regiments of the American ground forces, and citing that they are training in Romania and they are going to defend every inch of NATO territory, which is the standard line from NATO officials and US military men, because they know very well that the Russians aren't going to go into NATO territory, and for all the protestations of the Zelensky regime, Ukraine is not NATO territory. But they said, oh, we're ready to go in if required. And this merits some examination, because, of course, it appears as if some American officer is making some threats to go into Ukraine. Now, what would, though, the American 101st Airborne Division actually be able to do if they went into Ukraine? Now, would they be going in as the tip of the spear thing, with a full-on American invasion to follow? I very much doubt that. I very much doubt that, because even though Biden is off his chump and there's various maniacs that appear to be in power in the United States, they've always had those people. There is an understanding, at least within the state structures and military of the United States, that if they do that, then that's full-on war, and then that's nukes and everything's over. So whereas the American ruling class, or the American political elite, are perfectly prepared to sacrifice every single person in Ukraine, probably every single person in Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and just about everywhere else in Europe as well, if it would serve their interests, they're not prepared to have their own country turned into an irradiated mess. They're not that crazy. And so what would the circumstances be under which American troops would be deployed into Ukraine? And here is my speculation. I would think that the only way that they would go in would be if they had reached some sort of tacit understanding, if not acceptance, from the Russians that the Americans were going to deploy into a certain area. That is the only way I would think that they would actually put ground forces into Ukraine. And bear in mind, even if they do this, they've got to have some sort of plan for what they're going to do with them. Are they going in just to create some sort of buffer zone to save what can be reclaimed from the collapsing Ukrainian state, to stop a complete collapse, to stop Russia getting control over a place like Odessa, to stop Ukraine becoming landlocked? And even if they do go in, what are they going to do long term there? Are the Americans going to militarily occupy this? This becomes a new front line for the foreseeable future. Is it going to be a case where they back up the Poles and grabbing Western Ukraine? Or what? What is the plan? So I would say that the only way they would do it was if there was some sort of understanding reached with the Kremlin over the division of Ukraine into spheres of influence. And given what the Kremlin leadership has been apparently moving towards in terms of their conclusions, I would say that that is not on the cards for now. Never rule anything out, but I would say that what is on the cards for now is that the US war plan, never mind about, you know, what Warsaw's plan is or the Baltic plan is, what the US plan is to continue spinning this war out as it is. And that, of course, is not what the Ukrainian regime wants, so there's every chance that the Ukrainian regime might do something crazy. But I would point to two things here. First of all, There was another conversation between Lloyd Austin, the Raytheon shareholder, and Secretary of Defense, and General Sergei Shoigu, Minister of Defense of the Russian Federation recently. Now, you can dismiss this as not very meaningful, but the reason why they have these conversations, the reason why Milley, General Milley, calls General Gerasimov on a regular basis is to avoid direct Russia-US clashes. Because, you know, Austin might be a corrupt bastard and a cynical bastard, but he's not insane. Same with Milley. He might be an opportunist and a careerist and everything the US right-wingers say about him, General Woke, etc. But again, he's not insane either. And they are trying to basically run this so they avoid direct clashes, but they keep Ukraine in the fight. Now, that's tremendously cynical and brutal and no good for Ukrainians, but that is the way they are managing this war. And it's the way they will go on managing it. Secondly, Wallace, our turnip-headed Secretary of Defense, our MOD guy here, he recently reported to the House of Commons, belatedly, because this happened back in September, that the Russians fired on a British jet, a military jet that was in the Black Sea, after it got locked on. Now, he spoke to Shoigu, and Shoigu said, oh, it's a terrible accident. It was a misfire. Don't take it personally, Ben. And Wallace accepted this and says they didn't want to escalate, etc., etc. Now, this has been the line, the careful line that people like Wallace walked down, because as I've said before, not only do they not want a war with the Russian Federation, which could go nuclear very quickly, other than the United States, and even there, there's questions. None of these European countries, particularly not Britain, can fight a war with the Russians. Never mind fight a war in Ukraine. I mean, the British army's probably in as parlous a state as it was back in the days of the original Crimean War, all the way back in the 1850s. And again, I'll emphasize this point. We do not have the industrial base in this country to fight any kind of war with the Russians. Any kind of war. The submarines that the British have got probably get blown out of the water in a few days. The British Army would run out of ammunition after a week, and most of it would be destroyed by Russian air power. The British Air Force will get knocked out of the sky in a few days. It's just, there is not enough equipment, there is not enough men, there is not enough industrial base in the country to rebuild all this stuff, or even build the British Army back up to the levels it was during the Cold War. In fact, the incoming government, led probably by Rishi Sunak, I will be doing a separate broadcast on the potential of a Boris comeback, stay tuned for that, gives every indication they're going to cut defence spending. So, what does that tell you? It tells you that they have no intention of going to war in a serious way with the Russians, and they don't have any capability to do it. And you might say, well, what about the rest of Europe? France isn't on board for this. No matter what Macron says, he's in a very weak political position. Scholz, God knows, but the German army's not capable of doing it any more than the British is. Meloni, who seemingly lives to kiss the feet of NATO and all its projects, well, Italian army's not going to be doing much either. And they're the biggest in Europe. Forget Spain, Portugal, Poland, the rest. No matter what the Poles say about building up their military, none of them are in a position to go in a serious toe-to-toe slug match with the Russians. The Russians, of course, are aware of that, and that is part of the reason why they are not deploying the gigantic numbers that they could deploy inside Ukraine. They are keeping many of their forces back, very carefully managing them in order that they can show proper discouragement to, in case any of the lunatics in the Baltic states or Poland to get ideas about doing something. I doubt they will. None of these cowards have the courage to do anything without the Americans firmly being in their camp, and the Americans aren't as firmly in their camp as any of these guys would like to think. So the war will continue as it is, I think. There's always a chance of things going wrong. There's always a chance that this carefully managed process the Americans are engaging in could go wrong. But at the moment, the cynical game that is being played will continue, which is the Americans will continue giving Ukraine weapons, the European Union will continue paying them, and the Ukrainians will continue dying in large numbers. And this leads me back to Kherson again, which is now being evacuated of civilians. It is being turned into what appears to be a sort of armed and fortified city by the Russian armed forces. They show every intention of either holding it or making sure that the Ukrainians pay an enormous price to make any progress down there. And again, every advance the Ukrainians have made in the last few weeks up to back in September has come at enormous costs with minimal casualties for the Russians. And so sticking by that old maxim that you have to destroy the enemy's forces, then the Russians are doing that, even when they're trading territory to do it, which enrages a lot of Russian observers. But it is working. It is working. And eventually, when the Russians are ready to move, which will probably be a month from now, 6 weeks from now, they will be ready to move in a serious way to move towards the end of the war, I would imagine. So that's the rundown of the situation and some potentials that could happen. So I want to move now to look at an example of propaganda. And this was sent to me by Ash over Telegram. Others mentioned it as well, which is, this is a story run by US alternative media, Breaking Point, with Not Crystal and Not Saga. I think it's Ryan Grimm, and he's performing Whig. And it's been run, of course, by Channel 4 News, which is the liberal imperialists' news station of choice in Britain. And which is the idea that the Russians are going to blow up the Novaya Kakhovka Dam, which is a dam in the Kherson region, which has been occupied by the Russians for several months now. Now, this dam is, of course, a source of hydroelectric power. It is also a source of water for the cooling system of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, which I'll come to that later on. And it's also a source of water for Crimea. And the idea floated by, of course, Zelensky was that the Russians were going to blow it up. And this was a story that was dutifully picked up by Channel 4 News and repeated it ad nauseum. And it took on the same pattern as the same ridiculous kind of story, which was that the Russians were shelling the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant when they controlled it. Which is, of course, why the Ukrainians didn't want the IAEA team to go in there, because even though the IAEA team refused to say who was shelling it, if you looked at their releases on it, you couldn't reach the conclusion it was anybody other than Ukraine that was shelling it, because that's who was shelling it. And again, this story depends upon the person reading it. If you take the text of the Channel 4 story, it depends upon you not knowing where the front line is. It depends upon you essentially being willingly blind to the kind of way that the story is written, which is written in this vague terminology, like a major dam in Ukraine is being shelled by the Russians, when, of course, it's in a region that voted to join Russia. It's in a place where the Russians have had control of for many months. And it's a key strategic asset for the Russians in terms of their usage of it to provide water to civilians and also the critical nuclear facility in Zaporizhzhia. And so to believe this story, you'd have to be incredibly ignorant of what's actually going on, which is, if you're relying on Not Crystal and Not Saga at Breaking Points, or relying on Channel 4 News, then you are likely ignorant of what is going on. But it also relies on the years and years of propaganda about Russia and the government of, headed by Vladimir Putin, which is this idea that, oh, well, he's mad. The Russians are just mad. You know, they'll do anything. They're crazy. And again, this is an old, hesitate to use the word, but trope. This is an old trope that the Western propagandists have used for many, many years, that their enemies, their chosen enemies, who they have to demonize as crazy and irrational and capable of anything, no matter how self-defeating. And a reason why you want to do that with the Russians, why the propagandists want to do that, is because then you can sell stories like this and people can say, well, those crazy Russians, they'll blow up anything, even a dam they control. Because it makes no sense not only to blow up a dam you control when there's no danger of the Ukrainians taking it as of this moment, but also when you're cutting off key water supplies to facilities which are vital for your operations, such as the power plant or the water sources of Crimea, and also that the subsequent flooding that would take place would sweep away several temporary bridge structures that the Russians have built over the river there that's downstream of it. So, whereas I don't rule out that, of course, the Russian armed forces might blow up a dam if they were in a position of needing to retreat, and that blowing it up would be militarily advantageous to them, but at this point, it just doesn't make any sense. There is no military advantage that I can see, or that other observers who are more informed on military matters than me can see, that there's any advantage to them to do this at all. But of course, you spend years calling the Russian government insane, the Russians bananas, they'll do anything, those crazy bastards. Even they play 10D chess against themselves by blowing up their own assets. Again, to believe it, you'd have to have swallowed every single story about Putin the madman over the last decade. Whereas, of course, if you actually know anything about Putin's moves over the last decade, or even the 2 decades since he actually came into power as president, if anything, the man has been relentlessly rational and cautious and judicious in his use of force when he needs to. But, of course, none of that reality makes its way into the propaganda of the Western nations. They have to portray all of their opponents as insane, as dangerous, because then you, once you've primed the population to believe that, then the population will believe any story you feed them, even the most outlandish, like the New York Post coming out with the other day that the Russians were being handed rape kits, including a dildo and some Viagra. I mean, it's just the most ridiculous false narrative that's being planted there. And again, this goes all the way back into the time of the Soviet Union. And it's what the historian Grover Fuhr calls the anti-Stalin narrative. And the anti-Stalin narrative, set up during the 1940s, really, but really ramped up in the 50s, 60s, and aided, of course, by the revisionists inside the USSR itself, was the idea of Stalin the madman. Stalin the madman. He just wants to kill everybody. He's capable of anything. He'll kill the entire population if you believe Solzhenitsyn's bullshit. Just for a giggle. He's just mad. And again, I mentioned the portrayal of Stalin in the beginning of World War II as both cowardly and insane, which is, of course, what Anthony Beaver indulged in, and that kind of fake history. And the anti-Stalin narrative, once you have the narrative established, you can say anything. So once you've established it, Robert Conquest can claim that Stalin almost killed the entire adult male population of the Soviet Union. People will believe it. Because once your opponent has no way of contesting it, because of course they're thousands of miles away, there's very few people in this country, Britain or the United States, who would ever go there and see Russia or the old USSR for themselves. You can just say anything. Your opponent, the person you're writing about, is not going to sue you through the courts. You can build a whole career on just saying the most outlandish garbage possible, which is what Robert Conquest, Richard Pipes, and other so-called historians of the Cold War period did. Just say any old shit you could possibly come up with, no matter how mad or outrageous, as long as it fitted into that anti-Stalin paradigm, you could get away with it. You get paid very well for doing that kind of thing. Same is true now. A lot of people made a lot of money saying that Russia was rigging the American election. Robert Peston, this outrageous idiot who works for ITV News, formerly worked for the BBC, said the other day that there's a risk that the Russians could rig the Tory leadership contest. And I'm thinking, for whom? For Boris, who gave more support to Kiev than any other Western leader, even more than Biden? For Sunak, could do exactly the same thing, by the way, and was chancellor at the time of all this? Like, who? It's just a way of them, what they were preparing was, is if Boris was going to win, they were going to try and say he was a Russian plant, which is insane. It's absolutely crazy. But then again, once you've established this as a propaganda point, you can get away with anything. You can get away with anything, especially when, of course, what Trump did with regard to Russiagate was he capitulated to it and just took more and more anti-Russian measures. So it works as a great disciplinary mechanism within the political class. And, of course, all Keir Starmer needed to do was to tell the Labour left that they were all Russian puppets, and they all immediately backed off a statement criticising NATO. Yeah, good luck with the great socialists in the upcoming Labour government. I'm sure they're going to fight for you. So, to conclude on another point related to propaganda, I mentioned, of course, the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. And this is, again, another case where the Ukrainians are really desperate to take this back again. They have now apparently taken to building a force that consists mostly of foreign ex-special forces, so British, Polish, and American mercenaries, which they will again attempt to launch at this and seize this facility. Now, it does, of course, make sense because of the Ukrainian energy problems, of which I'll say more in just a moment about. But they keep landing these forces, they keep getting blown up, they keep getting driven back into the water, and they come back and they try again the next week. I guess they're hoping that they can just grind the Russians down, but it's a tremendously wasteful and very cynical way of conducting this war. Maybe after all the mercenaries have been killed on the next attempt, maybe they'll think twice about it. But again, a lot of, I mean, the reason why they're trying to seize this thing back, again, it's partly related to energy supply because it got cut off from the Ukrainian energy grid. But I would think that mostly it's a propaganda thing. It's another thing that Zelensky can wave in the air and go, see, Daddy Biden, I did good, you know? And a load more people will die, and another useless attempt to seize it will take place. Also, the Zelensky can have the remote chance of pleasing the old man in the White House, who probably can't remember Zelensky's name anymore. But that brings us to the question of the Ukrainian energy grid, which, according to Ukrainian sources, that between 30 to 40% of it has been knocked out. But there are other interpretations of this. Ukrainian sources that are outside of the Ukrainian mainstream and official channels are saying that one of the reasons why the government is now doing rolling blackouts in Ukrainian cities isn't actually that there's not enough energy, because the Soviet energy system with which Ukraine is equipped was built with such a huge capacity because it was meant to power this enormous industrial base that used to exist in Ukraine, which 30 years of capitalism had destroyed even before the Russian invasion in February, March of this year. And it's the huge excess capacity was actually being sold to countries in Europe. Interestingly enough, and I learned this only recently, the Ukrainian energy grid and the energy grids of all those Eastern European countries all used to be linked together as part of the Communist Bloc's economic organization, Comecon. And the energy grid was actually run out of a central switchboard in Prague. And this provided an integrated energy system for all of Eastern Europe, which is another great piece of efficiency from the Soviet period, long lost to the inefficiencies and corruptions of capitalism. But there you go. Anyway, the theory kicking around alternative channels in Ukraine is that they are prepared to sink the civilian population into rolling blackouts in order that they preserve energy for military usage, which, from that, a certain point of view, does make sense. If you're going to try and ration anything, you want to try and keep the essential military stuff powered up. And if that means cutting the service to civilians at certain times of the day, then you'll probably make that choice. This does indicate, though, that even if we assume that the upper end estimate of 40% being knocked out is true, there's still an awful lot of redundancy built into this Ukrainian energy system, which means that the Russians will have to keep up this level of assault on not just the power facilities themselves, but on the substations that distribute the energy through Ukraine before they can actually start to seriously damage the capacity that the energy system has to supply the military side of things with. So worth keeping an eye on that. Likelihood is that the Russians continue to bombard the substations and the power routes, along with a lot of other Ukrainian infrastructure, in order that they can get as much of Ukraine, and certainly Ukraine's armed forces, cut off from electricity usage by the time the Russian big maneuvers come, maybe in late November, early December time. So that's the end of the update for today. I'll be back again same time tomorrow. And if you have any stories that you want me to cover on this update, or you want me to look at any particular subject area, then feel free to either at me on Twitter or leave a comment on the Telegram chat feature. That's a good way of sharing stories amongst those of us in there for further discussion. So thank you for listening, and I'll be back with you again tomorrow.
to kill.